Sorry to rush along. We're just moving. We're having so much fun. Just remember that you only get 10 minutes for lunch today, but it'll be worth it. Believe me, I promise you it'll be worth it. Okay, so I'm now we're moving along to our Mexican friend, Juan Pasco. Juan Pasco is a man I've been hearing about for much of my printing career, but always at a great distance because he's since I began printing, he's been rarely, if ever, in San Francisco, and I was never privileged to meet him. So last month, I took the bit in my mouth, and I went down to meet Juan Pasco in Michoacan. Juan Pasco was born in Chicago, Illinois, in 1946. Received his Bachelor of Arts degree in English at Whitman College in, of all places, Walla Walla, Washington. It has that wonderful sonorous name, Walla Walla. And it's a remote place in a neighborhood in which they grow a lot of peas in the eastern, far eastern Washington. After college, in the Pacific Northwest, served a single-year apprenticeship or a one-year apprenticeship with Harry Duncan, perhaps America's greatest printer of modern poetry on the hand press, at the Cummington Press in West Branch, Iowa. To study with Duncan was not only to learn the difficult craft of printing on a cast-iron hand press, but at the same time to study with a master of the intricate arts of typography. Following his apprenticeship, Juan moved directly to Mexico City and founded and discovered or acquired a Washington hand press in Toluca and began printing in Mexico City in 1973. In his first books were mostly books of poetry. The list of his friends and fellows reads like a roster of the most exciting artists and poets of his day. Roberto Bolaño, Carmen Bulosa, Octavio Paz, José Luis Rivas, forgive my terrible pronunciation. From 1978 until 87, ever so briefly, he moved around. So from 78 to 87, he formed part of the Grupo Mono Blanco, playing traditional music from Veracruz. And he says, with money earned from music, I bought an 18th century sugar mill in rural Michoacan, and which is where he's still living and printing to this day. Far now from the social circles of poets, he says, and musicians in the city, his books in the past 20 years have been more oriented toward matters of early Mexican typography and printing. And I think this is incredibly important work, his work on the early printing press in America. We are very short-sighted in the United States of America. We think that printing was invented by Benjamin Franklin. We came to discover much more in his workshop when we visited, and he showed us some of the early books in the New World. When we visited him for a short and very intense afternoon last fall, my wife Susan took some photographs of his stalwart hacienda, and we celebrated my 66th birthday with lunch, song, and drinks with his friends. And so what you will be watching, and I'm disconnected from this talk, is just a little tour of his workshop. So, Juan, thank you.
Ever since this codex... Whoops, I have to do something.
Button. Yeah. Oh, technical help. Technique. We don't have to make all that stuff go away, and we just have a simple show. And that horrible thing to go away. There you go.
I was invited to the first Codex, and I said, well, I don't know what that is. No, I can't go. I was invited to the second Codex. I kind of got an idea of what it was about. But, no, of course I'm. I've never been to San Francisco. I'm not going to San Francisco. And so then this third one was coming up, and I wasn't going to come to this one either. Yeah, I thought that would be better. And then, so they go down. Then they said, okay, I got a letter, we invite you up, please speak. Okay, I'll go. And they said, would you like to have some slides? I said, no, time for slides. And anyway, you spend your time looking up at slides and you're not even listening to me, so no slides. So they went down and they took the pictures. And then I got a formal contract and it said, you've got to write so many thousand word piece about what you're going to talk. I said, impossible, please take my name off the list. I don't have time to write anything about my work. I'm busy on a book. It's got to finish. This was already 2 months after the bicentenary celebration in Mexico, and I had a book that ought to have been finished the 16th of September to celebrate 200 years of independence of Mexico. I've been trying to get out of this since it began. And then I don't remember what else I told him. I said, listen, just, I can't go. Here I am. I'm here. He gave me a title. The title is Fine Printing in Mexico. I said, very easy. There's absolutely nothing to say. There's no... So I get up here, tell you there's nothing to say, and a little bit about why there's nothing to say. And then I can sit down and we can go back and walk around the aisles there looking at books. Well, I sat down to write something. And you will be able to read it entire in its entirety if you purchase. I don't know if you all get free copies of this book.
God forbid.
Okay, there you have it. But if you purchase the book, you'll have this thing in full. And I talk about the people he mentioned, and I talk about the books. It is a star cast, but I chose the star people. I'm going to read a little bit of the first part of my, what I wrote, partly because I talk about Harry Duncan, and people along the way as I've been talking, they say, oh, nobody knows about Harry Duncan. None of these people know about Harry Duncan. I say, well, it's okay, he was a printer. And also I have to talk about myself, and I feel compelled in front, particularly the Mexicans that are here in the audience, to defend my right to be a Mexican, because I certainly don't look like one, and I don't sound like one. There is a fair amount of printing going on now in Mexico, and when I began in 1973, there was none. And so I had this idea that the Mexican graphic arts people, what they really like is having a nice studio, a really good Mac, or a bunch of them, good rug, a good-looking secretary, good coffee maker. And then there's a kid that they send down to the print shops. Everybody's working on the Macs, doing things. And I suppose it happens in... I haven't even seen these, so please laugh if there's something to laugh at. Okay. They send them down to the printing office, which is in a grungy part of town, because printers are working class people. And then the book comes back and the people get to smell the book and so forth and so on. In the last few years, and I've noticed it particularly in this fair, I came here to learn because I have no idea about printing in the United States or England or Germany or France or Canada. I live out in the sticks, as you're seeing. And I told Peter, I'm totally the wrong person to ask that question. Fine printing in Mexico. I know nothing. I know nobody. I live out in this place, and now we're surrounded by the narco situation. And so just live like this, no? Christmas, the narcos took over the state, and they said, no bonfires, no posadas, which is the walking around with the candles and singing Mary and Joseph trying to find the manger. None of that. No piñatas. Nothing. Everybody stay home. Yep, I stayed home. I worked on the computer. New Year's, I stayed home working on the computer. So I know nothing about fine printing in Mexico, except I've been finding here that there is more than I thought. And I'm quite impressed. that we're coming along. We'll talk about that after I read a little bit about my my printing. My great-grandfather was born in Helston, Cornwall in 1841 to John and Jane Pascoe, both of the mining town of St. Columb Major. He came to Mexico and he was named James Pascoe. He came to England, to Mexico in 1865, just after Benito Juarez nationalized the church's property. And particularly Benito Juarez looked at the problems of Mexico and the development of the United States and thought the problem was the church, the way the structure was. And so he wanted Protestants to come in and change things, get everybody stop drinking and get serious about work, like you people. And then from then on, he was known as Don Santiago Pascoe. He worked as a surveyor and engineer in the San Pedro del Monte silver mine near Ixtapan del Oro, where he lived with his Cornish wife, Carolyn Williams, and they had four daughters, two of whom died. Thanks to his inheritance, his father had been the owner of a copper mine in Redruth, Cornwall. Santiago was well off and had a mine in Mexico, but there was a lot of highway robbery, and he didn't do so well economically. And he turned his attention to his real interest, which was evangelism. This was that time of England. Not Church of England, not Methodist, not Quaker, not Presbyterian, no sect at all. With each of these, he found fault. He was an independent Christian who believed in the original, primitive, direct, and simple gospel. The enemy was not Aztec heathenism, but the Holy Roman Catholic Church. The government had put up the church's property for sale, and Don Santiago bought the 16th century Franciscan temple in Santa Cruz, Miahuatlan. He cast down the cross, he took all the little saints and broke them into little pieces and declared this to be a Protestant church, which it is to this day, and the only one that I'm aware of in Mexico that is like that. Except in the downtown Mexico City, the Methodist Church on the street of Gante, formed part of the Franciscan convent. And so these are only two, viruses, we could say. Heartened by his success with a rural and scattered village of poor Masawan Indians, he moved to the state capital, Toluca, set up a congregation and a press for printing evangelical literature. Nothing known about him indicates any technical typographic training. He'd had a two-volume novel published by Richard Bentley in London in 1862, and had a couple of little books printed, and I suspect that it was going to this print shop and correcting proofs and seeing the machinery that he looked it over. And similar to the experience of Leonard and Virginia Woolf in 50 years later in England, they just bought a press and with a little booklet got going. But what he had bought was a big cylinder press for real printing and not a little treadle press the way Leonard and Virginia did. He found Toluca cold and conflictive, and when his wife Carolyn died in 1875 in childbirth, he married Juana Gomez, the eldest daughter of his principal assistant Nicanor Gomez, which is where my middle name comes from. And he moved back to the hills. He left the steam press in Toluca under the direction of Gomez and an English printer and took the magazine with him. And judging by the mountainous landscape, he would have taken a hand press made to break down into pieces transportable by carts and mules. He had a team of assistants in San Telmo who did the printing, and he sat at a desk all of his life and wrote radical evangelical religious tracts. And he played the English concertina and a trumpet. And I mean by trumpet an instrument called a clarín, not a trompeta of soldiers, no? A clarín must be what Mozart's people played. He had three children with Juana. The first was named Frank after his brother, and the youngest was Juan Nicanor after his own father and his father-in-law. This is my grandfather, who was 6 months old when Santiago went to England and died. The printing came to a halt. Juana was left with the promise of English Christian support. The inheritance was gone, but this never arrived. The country house was too dangerous to live in without him, so ox carts of furniture, books, the press, the type, the plates were taken to Capulhuac in the valley of Toluca. Juana brought up her children washing clothes in the city of Mexico. She had no money. And bit by bit, everything was sold, and so all that we're left with by now were one set of these magazines that he printed called El Heraldo, and some photographs, and an oil portrait of he himself. Once an aunt, one of his daughters, told my father and myself where a bookcase of beveled glass with books and papers in English were to be found, and that we were free to have it all. We went at once to the village, and an old Indian woman at an inn, whose mother had known Don Santiago, told us that years before the church had been burnt by an angry mob, the papers scattered underfoot, and nobody remembered a bookcase. Juana Gomez died young, and her children were brought up by Mary Amelia, who was born in San Telmo. Nicanor got his degree at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He spoke English well, but with an accent and a very slight trace of England. And he became a Methodist minister. His first church was in Laredo, and he married Elisa Strozzi, daughter of a Swiss-Italian miner, Pietro Strozzi, and a new Mexican-Spanish woman named Juana Archuleta. Elisa spoke English with an unplaceable accent and flawless Spanish and became a Protestant. From 1936 till the end of their lives, they translated the Upper Room, which is a little Methodist monthly things to read and at the table before everybody runs off, into Spanish, and she directed the temperance movement in Mexico. They named their first son Santiago and their second one Juan. Juan learned English in his late adolescence and spoke with a Mexican accent. He studied at Springfield College in Massachusetts. He married Dorothy Pierce, and, well, I was born. I was born to them in Chicago and was named Juan Nicanor. They came to Mexico City in a few months, she and I for the first time. He worked for the YMCA and met a group of U.S. Quakers who organized international volunteer work camps in rural villages. When I was six, they had two more sons. They moved to Sells, Arizona on the what used to be Papago Indian Reservation, i.e. my first entrance in the United States was to an Indian reservation. It wasn't even to white, this kind of a Berkeley thing. My Indian friends all spoke impeccable Papago, as it was called then, and English with a rural lilt, which I picked up at once. And since my family spoke English at home, and I hadn't quite begun school in Mexico, I spoke and speak Spanish with an accent. Juan Pasco Strozzi, my father, abandoned the Mexican militant Protestantism of his upbringing and entered the domain of socially minded, non-evangelical, meditative, nonetheless Christian and spiritual Quakers. And it was thus that I found myself, age 14, on a Transportes del Norte bus out of Mexico City, heading for West Branch, Iowa, and hence by car a 1 mile east to the Quaker farm boarding school named Scattergood. Our typing and art teacher, Nancy Duncan, had recently married a book printer from the University of Iowa. This fellow, who was older than she, but dashing and always wore a clip-on bow tie, the way I see some of you guys wearing these days, was presumably a big deal. And I heard it said there were three reasons people went to the University of Iowa: the writer's workshop, the graphics instruction of Mauricio Lasansky, and the printing of Harry Duncan. Nancy was dazzled and in love with him. We heard a lot about his charm, his wit, his intelligence, his poetry, his books, his cooking. She did not mention his moods, and she didn't mention his cobra-like retorts. And any of you that were ever in a book conference with Harry Duncan sitting in the audience will know about those retorts, or if a little bit later he had something to drink, he got even worse and sharper. This is always true. She didn't hide the fact that they were Catholics. And that to a young Mexican, English, American, militant, evangelical Protestant living under the wings of Quaker discipline seemed very odd. When I finished college, I drove from Walla Walla to Tenafly, New Jersey, where my parents had a house, rented out, but with a couple of rooms for us. Midway across the country, I spent the night with the Duncan family in West Branch, and that's where I found where they kept the Cummington Press books, scattered among all the other books in the house, in the living room, in a plank bookcase. The books looked different, smelled different, and I was pretty impressed. I just finished literature, English, college English, me, and Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, Ellen Tate. I was definitely impressed. The first thing Duncan asked me that evening as we drank a couple of dry martinis was, whom did I consider to be the greatest American living poet? I searched wildly in the air for a name, feeling caught. Auden is what I said. I had a poem of his that had just come out in the New Yorker, cut and pasted in the top cover of my English concertina. I didn't know about my great-grandfather, but I played that. Possibly, he responded, although there's some debate as to whether or not he's American. He must have seen through me at once, and he didn't insist. And he'd been totally unimpressed when I played his kids some jigs and reels in the garden, and they had danced and danced. I left my 1959 Morris Minor in the garage and left for Mexico. It was alternative service to the draft time for me, and I'd been accepted at a rural work camp in the state of Puebla. I was American then, and I was both American and Mexican. And the Mexicans, in Mexico, Mexican law is a suggestion, but the United States it's absolutely. I mean, no messing around with selective service, no. Not just no. So I had to do it. I spent my Sundays hitchhiking into Mexico City and going straight to the second book stalls on the street in the Lagunilla, buying very little on my Quaker stipend, but looking it all over and attending literary events. Octavio Paz had just returned from India, and I was impressed at the ease with which his readings could be attended, at all the poets and the painters in the audience, and at the cultural group in Mexico City. It was small and illustrious, and everyone knew one another. I observed that although there were publishing houses, there was no printer of the Duncan sort, neither in Mexico, nor in Argentina, or any other country in between. My parents were with the United Nations Development Program living in the Sudan, and sometimes we talked by shortwave radio, but they didn't have too much of a sense of me or what I was heading. Father wanted me to be a writer, and I wanted to stay away from boarding schools and universities, and not being a teacher seemed to be the best way to achieve that. Grassroots literary life was to be found amongst the writers, in writing itself, but also in printing books by hand in the territory where the writers worked. I ignored the comfort factor of professorship. The salary, the health insurance, the pension plan, the jingling change in the pocket for antique books. My parents were young, and there was nobody around to point out to me that life was swift, but long and expensive, and it had to be lived well and paid for. I wrote Nancy Duncan a letter asking if it were possible for Harry to take me on as an apprentice. She answered they'd both like it very much. That's coffee. We grow our own coffee and toast it, and the Kochs really dug that, and they liked the coffee. She said, try to be here on such and such a day in August, because they were going to Maine for a month, and it would be perfect for me to stay in the house while I figured out where to live. When I arrived from Tenafly, driving my brother's 1964 red Peugeot sedan, he was in the Dominican Republic working with a group of Marxist Catholic priests, and I couldn't get the Morris Minor to start, and I never saw it again. It was lunchtime, and there was a whole group of people there. This was the Cummington Press in the summer, which is that they were working. There was a young woman there, kind of Marilyn Monroe, kind of young lady, Ashley Bullitt, the daughter of Carolyn Kaiser, the poet, and she just arrived from a season with Carolyn Hammer out on the East Coast. And she had said, if you want to learn how to print, go with Harry Duncan. So she went there. There was another guy, Greg Fox, who was there to learn how to print, and there was me, who wanted to learn how to print. And we had this little war of apprentices there. It happens with apprentices, no? After lunch, Greg and all the Tom people sat in a card table with me, and we folded pages. It was the Barry Goldenson's Saint Venus Eve in duodecimo, which meant an eight-page section, and then another page folded upon it. It was a little square book. And Tom Miller explained to me how the illustrations and the beginning defined the formal elements of the book, and how the drawing was cut up with a hacksaw and used in the original position, but each bit alone to introduce the different sections. That it was not constructed in the traditional Renaissance book. And this is just that these guys explaining to me, who knew absolutely nothing about anything. Harry and the two women, Ashley and Denny, were in the press room setting up the press for the next day. There were more martinis in the evening. And the secret, this is the big Duncan secret, the secret is in the vermouth. And it's got to be good, and you can skimp on the gin. And dinner was prefaced by a spoken prayer. Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts which we are about to receive through thy merciful bounty, in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Whereupon they all crossed themselves, and a couple of seconds later, as is common with Protestants, so too did I. Crossed myself, and I betrayed all of my family, the whole, everybody. Anyway, he said, then later after dinner, he said, it was hard for him to be very enthusiastic about the sort of poetry being written nowadays, and the only poem he had read recently was by John Berryman and had come out in the New York Review of Books, that the whole matter of printing, ever since he had begun back in Massachusetts, had been up against an ever swifter modernization of the industry, and that they hadn't found anyone at all in the early days who knew in practical terms how to operate a hand press. It had all been printing manuals and hit and miss. He also said that the present was as good a time as ever, as there ever had been. Presses were not difficult to find, type was still being cast, fine paper was available, the poets were writing, the buyers were reading, and the best part of it all was that there was no longer any competition. And he met Stanley Morrison, and he wouldn't have believed that 20 years later, whatever this is, there would have been a book fair like this. No competition, my foot. It's quite humbling to see the labor, all of you people. When, you know, I live off in this place, and you know, I thought that there was no competition. Until yesterday I came here. The next day I helped him to print the final run of the book. He wasn't a teacher. Harry Duncan was not a teacher. We went into the press room, and he stood in front of the press, and he said, this is the arm, this is the foot, this is the tympan, this is the inner tympan, the outer tympan, this is the this, this is that, this is that. Okay, and get to work. Get over on the other side, and you put the piece of paper like this. And that was it. That was all he ever told me about that. Printing. He didn't talk. He didn't talk shop. We didn't sit around talking about Stanley Morrison and Beatrice Ward and goblets, all that. Nothing. We drank goblets. But he inked the form. I took a sheet of dampened paper from the pile, wrapped in a rubberized tablecloth. Now we have plastic bags. And placed it centered on the points upon the tympan. When we opened the frisket after the impression and he inked it up again, I flipped the sheet over, placed it on the pins precisely. At one point, he expelled a gasp of exasperation, and this is typical Harry Duncan. Unlocked the chase, took out the line and placed it in a composing stick, fiddled around with the type case and put the line back into the press, locked it up, planed it, and inked for another impression. I saw, when I took the twice printed sheet off, that he had put my name in the colophon. He put my name in the colophon, I said to Nancy in the kitchen in the evening as she made supper, feeling I had entered literary history and the seed of my fame had been planted. He did it because it made his line look better, she said. But he says you have rhythm and that no helper since his partner Paul Whiteman Williams, who died in 1956, had taken to it with such ease. So, you know, that was okay. That was okay to hear. This is a parenthesis. In 2008, still under debt to them for my education, and because she, Nancy, had given me his Ostrander Seymour hand press when he died, I compiled a 232-page book entitled Harry Duncan in Iowa, 1956-1972. And in it, towards the end, I sketch out my apprenticeship. It exists in PDF form, burned onto about one-fourth of a blank CD, copies of which are held at the Taller Martin Pescador collections at the Bancroft Library, at the University of Arizona, at Princeton. I sent copies to the Duncan family, to various of his admirers, to the two universities where he worked, Iowa and Nebraska, to Grinnell College where he studied, Amherst College, which adores him, University of Atlanta, where the Cummington Press papers are, and to Tom Taylor, who had published books of his in Texas. I consider thus that my book is widely held, and I don't have to talk about it. And if you want to see it, you can go to the Bancroft Library if you want to read it. But nobody ever said anything about it. There's Duncan kids, silent. Iowa, whom I'd hoped that I would say, your book is absolutely great. We've got to publish it. How do we do it? No. Omaha? Nothing. Grinnell? So far. They didn't even write letters of thanks, no? So I drove the Peugeot next summer 1972, from Iowa down the spine of the USA to Laredo, Texas, and I sat on the border in the car, which had no air conditioning, and it's July in Laredo, and waited in a sunny queue of motor vehicles to leave the humid U.S. and enter dry Mexico. I rolled a Bull Durham cigarette and considered my prospects. The Duncans were leaving Iowa for Nebraska. The printing is no longer delegated to the light of the moon, but occupies the central sunlight, he was to write me. And I had probably overstayed my time with them anyway, even though he wrote wishing I'd been around to help carry boxes. I had no place in the USA to even set up a tent. My parents were in Africa. I read a comment about characterless young American printers unable to develop styles beyond those of the iconic printers Baskin, Duncan, Everson, Hamady, Merker, Stauffacher, Van Bleet, or however that one's pronounced. I thought if I were to leave the English language into a different tradition, I might be able to find a way for things to look differently. Even if I came from a minority group in race, religion, and accent, Mexico was also my country. All the American printers I had met, three of the ones I just mentioned, worked at universities, and they endlessly complained about the administrative requirements that their jobs kept them from printing. And I mean, mostly Duncan and Kim Merker, they're just all the time complaining about faculty meetings and... But they all did print quite a lot, no? But that life in the U.S. was so expensive that it was impossible to live off mere printing. I think most of you know that, too, no? These were the days previous to the invention of accountability. The invention of the word accountability. I had seen that Mexican politicians and businessmen commissioned sophisticated portfolios of etchings and lavishly made books to give away at Christmas, and I thought a hand press operator might be able to cash in on this. And it's also possible, just possible, that I was afraid of the USA and that I was inventing a niche I could occupy in Mexico. I had reached the end of the line. I'm here on the border in my car. And it was my turn. I left the car in the customs official's hands to go through the contents. Books, instruments, cowboy boots, a hat, nothing valuable or suspicious, even though I did think my half dozen Cummington Press books were valuable. But you know, it's Mexico, you don't have to say that to them. They ask you when you come in the United States, are you bringing anything valuable? Nah. All these things that I hope would be bought up excitedly here at this place. A big, hot, smoky room filled with desks, counters, fans, secretaries doing their nails, bejeweled immigration officials whose signatures were required on the papers, fingering cigarettes on stained ashtrays, squares of paper with on top of their Coca-Cola bottles, glasses. One had to take the sheaf of papers from desk to desk, begging the flourish of a pen and a stamped seal, sometimes finding that a certain indispensable document or signature was missing. And hence, with an irritated stare of time lost, the process was ended, nothing could be done, I couldn't continue, I had to return home. Until five under-the-counter bucks, the cost of a Cummington press book in those days, transformed the stern blockade into a disinterested smile, a signature, and a stamp, and for better or worse, I was in. And I'm going to stop right there, and you can read all of the rest of it about how I, the adventure of going. But I wanted to tell you mostly about that little bit and the connection with Harry Duncan. I've been, now this was 1972, and here we still are. Still not rich, still printing. I live in this place that you're looking at. It's a big old house in a very beautiful place. It was very cheap. And when people, when there's all of this fear around that I'm going to be kidnapped by the other band of people, because everybody thinks I'm rich. They think I'm an hacendado. And they think I'm an hacendado because I lived in the hacienda. And yeah, sure, indeed, at one point, wealthy people there, they say, come on, you guys, I'm a book printer. What do you think? What are we talking about here? When they ask $3 million for ransom for me, exactly. It hasn't happened yet, but you might be hearing about it at one point. Peter Koch, I'll take him on as my representative of things in the United States, and he could print up some very pretty little thing. Any of you can print up a very little pretty thing and send them out and say, we're collecting, donate $25 to get this printer out of hock. By and large, Mexican people who could print don't print, because it didn't occur the way it did in England, Europe, that people, particularly in the late 19th century, with time on their hands, found out about the pleasures of using their hands and making things. And in this society that I live in, the further one can be from getting one's hands dirty, the higher up in class one is. And so this is why we have these nice studios where the book designers are, and they send the kid off to down to the print shop to print the things. I see that's changing. That was one of the things I was going to tell you. I see that's not quite true, because there's quite a lot of Mexicans around here, and they're all printing. They're now producing books, and so the business of the pleasure of mixing physicality with intellectual endeavor seems to be catching on, and great. I'm all for it. I think it's obviously the way to go. You people have we see it right here in the room where we are, the amount of materials available. All those marvelous leathers and parchments, and then the piles of paper from Quebec and all the binding. Materials are not your problem. No? What I find in materials are our problem. Very definitely. One of the things I was going to mention was the matter of type. Unfortunately, the world was divided up between the Englishmen and the Americans, and the Americans got the Western Hemisphere. And the Americans were not Stanley Morrison. I wish we had had a Stanley Morrison here who was at the head of the Monotype Corporation. The way all of the rest of the world prints with Monotype, even though it's all made in Europe or in England. But in the United States, it was somebody else, but they filled Latin America with pretty cruddy type. designed type. And so it's very difficult for me. It's impossible for me. I don't buy Mexican type. I buy type in upper state New York, in a town I can't pronounce, or here, M&H type, or the Dale Guild, that kind of thing. It's getting more difficult. But I wish and I hope at some point that some other loony guy buys up some monotype casters, is able to install the things, make them work, and bring some good matrices and make type available for Mexican book printing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Here.
Okay, good. And we do have an Italian fellow, Pasquale De Ponte, who makes paper. He can make paper by hand. He has a machine for mold-making paper, which is what basically I go with. It's good fibers, fairly cheap. Certainly cheaper than other numbers I've been hearing around here. And maybe this can develop. Maybe it can come into something. It's important in the collapse of society and the narco society that's, you all know about that in Mexico, to have things to do. The most important thing is that nothing is different now from ever before. And in 1600, Enrico Martinez, who was a German Spaniard who was cutting type and printing books, he said he was giving up the printing of books. He was a stunning printer, absolutely beautiful printer. There's a book on his work there on the table that we have in the book fair. And look at it a little bit. Look at the types he made. Look at the design and the capacity of him to impress upon a clean piece of damp paper. But after about 5 years, he said, it's absurd to be a printer here. It's too much work. Nobody buys books. He stopped printing. And the story is still kind of the same. Nobody buys books. There's 1%, came out in the newspaper the other Friday, 1% of the Mexican population has ever in his life read or bought a book. And everybody else buys big speakers for their pickups. And apparently this 1%, it was said in this article, has been going on throughout history. It's just that there's a population explosion going on, and less people are buying books. No? I think we've just got to be personal saviors of the tradition and not worry too much about everybody not buying the books. No? But the books to be made, the books available, the books that I have had the luck to be able to print are beyond belief. And I know and I recognize from the first moment that I made the correct decision in going to Mexico. I went to England a couple of years ago and traveled around visiting presses. And once again, beautiful houses, beautiful presses, types made by Eric Gill, that only this press has, and all that stuff, bindings. But I got this feeling in England that it would be terrible to be a young person in England, because everything had been done already. And what you had to print was like a lot of what I've been seeing here, which is it's not a bad thing. New work is what I mean. No? New work is what's available. But all the old stuff is done, it's been gone, it was done in the Victorian times. And in Mexico, nothing was done. It's all there waiting to be printed. And so, for example, a couple of years ago, I realized that in the National Library, there was the manuscript of 47 Aesop's Fables that had never been printed. In Nahuatl, translated into Nahuatl in the 16th century, and had never been printed. And I said, do I get this right? Aesop's fables in Europe were the cornerstone, the beginning of every printing tradition. The Germans, who were the number one geniuses of printing, made Aesop's fables into German fables by the woodcuts. Then the French made them into German fables by the woodcuts. The English, those fables do that. And here, the American, because I embrace all of you who live on this continent, the American Aesop's Fables was still in, this must have been 1997, still unprinted. And it's my, all I have to do is stride forth, get the manuscript out of the library and print them now, which of course I did. And I was lucky to have had this kid that had been hanging around the press for a long time, whose name is Artemio Rodriguez, and he's up in the crowd here, and he developed into exactly the linoleum cutter that I needed to do this book. And so we did the first American Aesop's Fables with illustrated, and of course they're turned into Mexican fables by this. Another thing, a little bit later, I was told the Colegio de Mexico has found a manuscript, Antonio Alatorre, has found a manuscript in the National Library of Portugal, a complete unprinted book by Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, the great Mexican colonial nun poet. And so it was my chance for the very first time, put this stuff into type. I said, this is impossible. No, in England, there's nobody's going to come up with a new play by Shakespeare, or the Germans, anybody, or the French. So I was able to do that. So I just go back and forth between this lucky thing and that lucky thing, and it's all there from Mexico. And so any printer here, Mexican, or that wants to be, there is work for a couple of centuries of available things to do, no? And most of the time, people don't buy it. This is the problem we have. In Mexico, I read recently a little pamphlet by Ward Ritchie about the printing in California, like from 1940-something. And he said, for the printing business of this, of ours, to work, we've got to have the printers, which there are plenty of. We've got to have book dealers. We've got to have buyers. We've got to have libraries. And it's got to be a chain that each part helps itself. Okay, well, what we don't have is the buyers. What mostly happens with me is that somebody will commission a book, and almost always it's the book that I want to do. That is, I find Aesop's Fables, and so I go, in this case it was the National University. And I said to the head of the National Library, do you realize what this is? Let's do it. So he got going, he's the one that got the money. I was able to print the book. I get money coming in while we're printing the book. We bind them up and we send them in a box to the National University, and it's up to them to deal with it. This year, the year that just passed, Mexico celebrated its 200th year of independence from Spain. And I knew that one of the most important elements of that was different in this particular war was the printing press. Because before, like Didier just mentioned, before nobody could have a printing press unless the king, and in this case the king of Spain, gave you permission to have a printing press. So there are very few printing presses in Mexico, and suddenly independence came. Not only independence, but also the development of cast iron hand presses, because all of those were wooden presses. The thing just broke open like that. And suddenly, all of the soldiers believed in the importance of the written word. And so they're writing tracts and they're passing them out. An important, exciting, big time for printing in Mexico. And so I printed a book. I said, the best thing that anybody can do is to hand print a book to celebrate the 200th year of... That's me talking, thinking, dreaming. Nobody else thought that, but I did the book. I did 12 documents printed in Oaxaca. Right at this time, the first one's adulating the king, and already the people are worried because population is kind of looking at this movement that's going on, and the particular church was saying, "Wait just a minute, everybody! This is bad stuff that you're pay no attention to it. We're Spain. We love Spain. We adore the king. Long live the king. So, long live the king." And this was a printer there, José María Idiáquez, who was in a convent, and the press that he had was the first press constructed in the New World, because most of them were brought from Spain, but I've been able to follow the... That is, I can't prove it to anybody. If somebody comes and I say, prove it to me. What I can follow is this print shop to that print shop to that print shop to that print shop, and my guess is that that was the press that was in Oaxaca in 1810, and this priest had it. And the moment José María Morelos, the leader of the opposition, came in, instantly he turned sides. Stopped printing stuff for the church, started printing stuff for the insurgents. And so these 12 documents that I printed tell the whole story of the insurgency. There's that coffee again. Oh, beer. Corona beer. And this is Artemio, the woodcutter, when you see the linoleum cutter. And well, that's me in the background. Little simple kitchen. I think if anybody would like to ask a question, that's really about it, which is that Mexico is a very great place, and if 2.5% of them are crazed madmen who seem to have taken control of the country, most everybody else is pretty nice, creative, friendly, tranquil, interested in the good things in life, and literary, big time. As Peter said, I lived in Mexico City for 10 years. I said, I'm going to live... I admired all those Bloomsbury people. And so I said, the obvious thing is to go live in the country, like Leonard in Virginia. And so I lived in Mexico City 10 years. I said, I'll become famous, and then I can go, I can live in the country and do nothing except print books for the rest of my life. Okay, well, that's fine, except that when you go out in the country, then the party stops. And the poets would come once and say, well, yeah, it's very nice, but it's awfully far. And then never come again. And so there I was left. So what do I print? You know? And so then I have become a little industry of my own of cooking these things up. I'm a big expert on Oaxaca printing. For no reason except that I'm a printer. That is, I'm not a historian, I'm a printer. And so I'm able to look at the early Mexican colonial books, and the bibliographers seem to look at title pages and colophons, and how many woodcuts are there. And my thing is, oh well, this press wasn't balanced, no? This, what's going on here? And so I look at the technical problems of the sort that all of us face, and that has been my mentor here is looking at his watch. And so, I will
take a question.
I will take a question. No, that's not a question.
That's a question. Yeah.
Oh, that's me singing happy birthday to him.